Welcome back to the podcast. I'm so excited to be jumping back into Pandora today with my very good friend, Scott Mendelson. Scott, it's been a little bit. How have you been?
Hi, I've been very well. In case people are watching this in the future, I'm driving home from work, which is about an hour-long drive. I am not staring at the screen. I am focusing on the road, the GPS map. But if you're wondering why it's like dark and gloomy where I am and I'm not really looking at the screen, that's why.
Okay, well, you're not being held hostage, as much as it looks like it. But I want to get my obligatory making Scott feel old comment out of the way. I don't know, you might be able to figure this out. I think you know my age now, but that means I was 8 years old when Avatar came out. And I hadn't seen it before last week.
What?
Yeah, I hadn't seen it. Look, my dad didn't take me to go see this one. Instead, and I looked it up, around the time of December 2009, I was seeing Alvin the Chipmunks, The Squeakle, and A Christmas Carol, which scared me shitless. So that was where I was at the age of eight.
My God. I mean, I get it. And even you didn't see the Princess and the Frog that season.
I don't think I've seen it, actually. I still don't think I've seen that one either.
It's pretty good, but that's another conversation. That is funny. I still have to look up how to spell Squeakquel every damn time. It's been 13 years, but and yeah, Christmas Carol, I enjoyed it. I think it is, in a funny way, it's actually one of the more faithful adaptations of the story. In fact, a lot of the dialogue is taken straight from the source.
Well,
But
it's
yes,
also
it is certainly
scary.
imposing. I imagine it would be very imposing to an 8-year-old.
Yes,
I
the
mean, there's a
little
problem with
demon
that.
babies or something that's in. I haven't seen it since then. So, but yeah, so that.
It's less scary at your age now,
Yes, I would hope
I think.
so, I think. Maybe that'll be your next commentary you do. We'll do a Christmas Carol.
If we're doing one of the mocap ones, we're doing Beowulf or Polar Express. Beowulf because it rocks,
Yes.
and Polar Express because. And this was really before your time. You were like, what, three?
Oh,
Speaking of Avatar, this is actually a good segue. I saw the Polar Express in 3D and IMAX on opening weekend, and it blew my socks off. This is one of those you had to be there moments. It was a quantum leap in 3D technology in terms of what I thought was possible at that time. And this was just like a year and a half after Spy Kids 3D Game Over, which. All due respect, I enjoyed that film. It was still like the 3D, the red and blue glasses, and all that silliness. This was just jaw-dropping. And I liked the film. I still think it plays well in 2D anyway, but in 3D, it was just a monumental, holy shit experience.
Well, I know you just made a great segue, but I have two comments about things you said. First, Polar Express. Yes, I was three when it came out. But I think I made up for that in that every school I went to, every year they'd show it up to, sixth grade. So I've seen it
God.
countless times. I've seen it too many times. And second thing
You've
was
seen it
the
the way it's meant to be seen at school on a tiny television in front of the assembly.
right on DVD and on a blurry TV. But the 3D glasses, I don't think I've seen a movie in 3D since I want to say one of the Amazing Spider-Man movies. I think it was the second one because
I hope it was the second one.
I think it was because I think I remember the web coming out of his, when he was trying to save Gwen. I'm pretty sure that was in 3D.
Yes.
I think so. That's what I think. But that said, it's been so long, I haven't seen 3D glasses since then. So when I walked up to when I was at the Avatar screening, I was so surprised that they were not like kind of like those red and blue glasses, or I think they upgraded to like slightly sunglasses. Now I just look like Bono walking into the
Oh,
auditorium,
yeah.
which felt pretty cool.
Yeah, everybody looks cool in 3D glasses now.
Yeah, so.
I would say the Polar Express was probably the first time I had glasses like that. Give or take a trip to the museum somewhere before that. Because this was 2004. This was before IMAXs were everywhere. So you either, if you lived in one of the big cities that happened to have a quote-unquote real IMAX, or you went to like a history, a museum, and you saw like a nature documentary for 45 minutes in
Oh
IMAX.
yeah, that's a good point. That's a good call. That took me back to my childhood. I forgot about those. That's
Took me back
what
to my childhood.
I do. That's my job. But yeah, so I mean, all these years later, I don't know how it feels for you. For me, it felt like it's weird seeing a sequel come out to a movie that first came out when I was 8, so now it's been, I'm 21 now. But I think I'm going to try to give somewhat of a synopsis. I'm so bad at these, so I wrote this down. You can correct me if I'm wrong or if I miss anything blatant. But obviously, Avatar, The Way of Water, it continues the story of Jack Sully and his family. But the humans are back, right, to avenge their last failed mission. And so Sully and his family leave, and they go to, and I don't know how to pronounce this. I think it's Makinia Reef. I don't.
I honestly don't remember.
Okay, I don't remember how they say it in the movie, so I'm gonna just call it the reef, the Waterlands. And so that is kind of, and obviously there's that adjustment period, but did I miss any, like once they get there, but did I miss anything blatant in that little synopsis? I don't know how to.
Think so. I mean, the first how half of the picture is basically, it's been 10 years, give or take, since the first film. Jake and Netira, is that Netira? I can never
Yes,
remember how to
yep.
pronounce that. Are living peacefully in Pandora. They have three children, and they've sort of adopted a child that somehow Sigourney Weaver's character births right before she died or something. And again, I think that's intentionally left opaque for a sequel, but I digress. So that's sort of a, like Jake and like Jake's children, she's sort of like a half human, half Na'vi hybrid of some kind. The humans show up again, but also like Kittredge, who perished in the first film, is back, but not really. And the Kittredge, the man, is dead. He is dead. He was killed in the first film. But as sort of a failsafe, they had his like consciousness implanted into a Na'vi, vessel. So you have this character played again by Stephen Lang, who, for all intents and purposes, feels like and acts like Kittredge. And he's very pissed when he finds out that Jake Sully betrayed the humans and got him killed. So he embarks on a very personal quest of vengeance. And in somewhat of a surprise, the clan, the little close-knit family, they decide not to stay and fight, but to get out of Dodge and become basically refugees in their own world. And they end up in a place that, if Pandora is a forest world, then this new place is a water world, basically. And they become refugees and outcasts, and they have to learn the ways of this new quote-unquote tribe. And that creates obvious conflicts and challenges between Jake and Netira and their children, who don't necessarily get along all that well with the leaders of this new clan. And I think that's it. I'm going off memory.
Yes, well, I know you saw it a few weeks ago, so props on you for that. But I did want to ask you, is it bad that when I was, like I said, I watched the first Avatar for the first time last week, and when I saw Stephen Lang in the film, is it bad that I thought of him as, oh, that's the Don't Breathe guy, or is that appropriate?
No, I mean, because I mean, it's, I mean, if you're an actor, you'll take whatever recognition you get. Some people are snobbier about that than others, Alec Guinness. But some people, like, Frank Langella loves the fact that he gets recognized by kids and now adults for playing Skeletor in the first in the Masters of the Universe movie. That came out in 1987, by the way. So that was probably before your time. That was when I was 7 years old. That was back when the idea of a live action, theoretically big budget movie, not quite, live action fantasy film based on a cartoon kiddie toy line was in itself somewhat of a unique event. And Frank Langella is a very prestigious actor, been working for decades and decades, but he still really enjoys being recognized by people that otherwise wouldn't know his work because they saw him in the He-Man movie. And I think there's something of value in that.
Okay, well, at least I didn't say, oh, Robert De Niro from Bad Grandpa. So at least I think it Don't Breathe's a little bit of a better comparison.
When I think of Stephen Lang, I first think of he played a villainous serial killer in a James Woods, Michael J. Fox action comedy called The Hard Way back in 1991. That was a film. It's worth your time if you have the time. It's about a stuck-up Hollywood movie star that basically embeds himself with a streetwise cop in order to do meth go method for a movie role. And Stephen Lang plays the serial killer that they're trying to catch throughout the picture. And that was just because that was the first thing I saw of it.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's Gabriel O'Brien has done a gajillion pictures, but I first saw him in, or at least I first noticed him in a Disney action comedy or a kid centric action adventure film called Shipwreck. It also came out in like 1990, 1991. Because that's when I was sort of, you know, I was, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, coming of age, becoming a movie nerd, and discovering all these established actors in these sort of Disney kids flicks. Or these, you know, I knew who he was, but the first Jack Nicholson performance I saw was, of course, Batman. Mm-hmm. And the first Gene Hackman performance I saw was Superman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And because I was a film fan, I was encouraged to seek out their other work too as a result of that. And there's a lot of talk in the discourse about how people that discover certain actors in like the MCU or DC films or whatever, they don't go outside the amusement park. And, you know, they're not going to, you know, watch Iron Man or Ant-Man, with which co-stars Robert Downey Jr. and Michael Douglas, they're not going to go out and see Wonder Boys.
Right.
And on one hand, yeah, that sucks. But on the other hand, you know, I only did that because I was a movie nerd. I don't know, you know, I certainly don't think that my classmates back then were going, I really enjoyed watching Superman. I'm going to go watch The Conversation now. That just didn't happen. Yeah.
Right, right.
Anyway, I'm getting off the beaten path.
No, that's okay. I mean, that answered my question. I just thought it was funny that I said that to my sister, who's younger than me. So keep that in mind. She was like, I don't know what you're talking about. But but I didn't know, like, I felt guilty because I know on film Twitter I would have gotten,
never
blamed for that. So
again, I first think of Stephen Lang as, you know, the random bad guy in some movie that 90% of the world has forgotten about.
Right. Okay, well, that's good. It's good. I get my validation from you, Scott.
I always tell my wife, always says, does she ever meet Tommy Lee Jones? She'll say that she loved him in Man of the House. And I explain that for most actors, that would probably be cute, but he might punch her. No, he might punch you. I make no promises.
That's true. He does.
He will not, you know, condone your buffoonery, or whatever that line is.
Yes. Well, I mean, to keep in line with that, I know we're getting off the beaten path of Avatar. This is completely separate. But when I saw the trailer for Man Called Otto, this sounds really bad. I'm not a big Tom Hanks fan. He's okay. But I was watching the opening of the trailer and just thought, oh, they videotaped Tom Hanks. What?
Sorry, you're not a big Tom Hanks fan.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. And I saw the trailer for A Man Called Otto, and they, you know, he's kind of grumpy in the trailer, and it started, and I just thought to myself, oh, they just filmed him candidly. So he seems like another guy, kind of like Tommy Lee Jones. I wouldn't necessarily want to tell him that. He might, but anyways, that's getting well beyond the...
Tom Hanks would laugh.
Okay.
Tommy Lee Jones would punch you.
Okay. Good. Well, but to get back to...
age.
To get back to Avatar and Pandora, I did want to ask, before we really talk about the film itself, what can you... can you tell me your thoughts on the film in one word? Like, what is one word you would use to describe it?
Good enough.
Okay.
That's two words, sorry.
That's two words, but I'll give you that. I'll give you that. Did you, now, did you review the film?
We're talking about the sequel, right?
Yes, we're talking about the sequel. I'm sorry, I should have clarified.
No, and I did not review it because I don't do reviews for the rap, so.
Okay.
I think William Babani reviewed it.
Oh, yeah.
And he seemed to very much enjoy it. And yeah, I will not be writing a formal review.
Okay, well, then I'm honored to have your thoughts,
folks.
Well, I'm very.
You can advertise this as the exclusive critical discourse for Avatar: The Way of Water from Scott Mendelsohn.
I know, and I know people's reactions will always be great. You always get great reactions to your reviews. But okay, good enough. That's fair. I mean, I think that's even though it's two, I will give you that. But I don't know where else to start with this movie besides the visuals. I just think that, to me, because similarly, I felt that I liked it a lot, but I think most of it was because of the visuals and the experience of it. So let's talk about those visuals. I mean, of course, we're expanding. For the first, you know, I hadn't seen the trailers for The Way of Water, I'll be honest. So I didn't know what the story was. And at first I was concerned. Like, and I also, like I said, I hadn't seen the first one. So I didn't really keep up with the news and the promotion of the movie. So I had no idea what the story was, so I didn't know if we would just be going right back to the forest. But we quickly expand, like we said in the synopsis, and we see a lot of underwater shots. I think they filmed the motion capture underwater or something like that, and a lot more vibrancy in this film, I think. But what did you think about the visuals? That's what kept me glued in the entirety of
Oh
this.
yeah, and it's even if you just about the audio visual, oh yeah, it's part of it. It's like I always love when people say, oh, this film was only good because of the cast. Well, yeah, but some of the cast, I mean that's why you cast XYZ and whatever. But anyway, visually, I thought it was breathtaking. I did see it in high frame rate 3D. In Dolby. And I don't know how much experience you've had with high frame rate. But I saw the first Hobbit that way, and I wasn't thrilled about it. So I saw and I don't think anyone else was too, because when they screened the sequels for press, the Hobbit sequels, they were all in 24 frames a second. I did see Ang Lee's the Gemini Man in H in high frame rate, which I thought was really impressive for what it was. I'll tell you what knocked me out, which was Ang Lee's Billy Lynn's long halftime walk, or I think whatever that movie's called. I apologize. That was a, did you see that? First of all, have you seen that movie at all?
No, but I fell asleep during Gemini Man, though, if that counts for anything.
Harsh. There's your review right there. The critics agree. I fell asleep. But anyway, that's fair, whatever. That was a film that felt incredibly immersive. It was like it's a film about a young man coming home from war and suddenly, but not explicitly, dealing with PTSD with a community that wants to revere him as a hero in a very pageantry way. And the film uses the high frame rate to basically capture his slightly off-kilter sense of disorientation as he returns to quote unquote civilian life. And it's a remarkable audiovisual experience. And it really felt like, I don't know if you've ever seen the play called Tony and Tina's Wedding. It's basically dinner theater, but you're at a wedding and you're seated at a table. And the wedding takes place around, the reception takes place around you. And a lot of the people sitting there are actors, and a lot of them are not. And this whole story unfolds around you in 360 degrees. And it's not a great show. As an experience, it's one of a kind. And that's the way, frankly, that's the way I felt about Way of Water. As an audiovisual experience, it's one of a kind. The high frame rate often made it feel like you were inside a VR simulation. I don't know if you've ever played, VR, either at home or at a place you pay like $30 for a half hour or whatever. It's not worth doing all the time, but every once in a while, it's a treat. And it kind of felt like that, where like I know here that it's not real, but physically it feels real. And it's so physically, emotionally, psychologically, when you're in these experiences, you're like you're stepping around as if you're afraid you're going to fall off a cliff or you're going to run into a wall. And it's I'm sure everyone looks fucking ridiculous when you're watching the video version of that. You have these people standing in basically an empty room, like they're blind people that are scared to run into a wall that isn't there, or fall off a cliff that's not there. It's very surreal. But The Way of Water, the way I saw it, did you see it in high frame or did you see it regular?
So I did see high frame, but it
Okay.
was in IMAX 3D, not Dolby.
Oh yeah, but it was still the high frame rate, right? That's how I what I got out of it. That it did have this skewed sense of immersion, especially in the water scenes. And obviously that's the reason for the season. He did the high frame rate because of the water scenes. I do think some of the live, the quote unquote live action above water high frame rate stuff does have a certain video gamey feel to it. like you're watching a cutscene of a very well put together video game.
Right.
But visually, I just it lived up to the hype. Mm-hmm. It really did. And I will let you talk. This is your podcast.
No, I love hearing that. And I mean, I think what you were saying kind of described it. Was I had a hard time describing to people why I love the visuals, but it did have, it's kind of like what you were saying. It did feel like VR, but in the best way possible. I don't think it was like when I say game looks, or I mean a movie looks like a video game, usually it's a bad thing. Like Black Panther's third act kind of looks like a video game, not in a great way. This, it kind of felt like a video game, but kind of like you said, I still felt like I was there, but it was so immersive that it was kind of like video gamey VR, like you said, but I know it's fake, but it also feels really real in this moment. And it's kind of hard to believe. Like, I think at times I was thinking to myself, like, is this real? Like, it was weird. Like, I really couldn't shake that feeling that I felt like I was there. Yeah, that was the best 3D I think I've ever seen. Granted, I haven't seen the first one in 3D, but I would kind of like to see it at home, at just out of curiosity of what that would look like with the high frame rate.
I mean, I'm taking my kids sometime this weekend, and honestly, we're probably going to go to 3D, but regular film, just because it's their one viewing, and I don't want them to, if they don't like it, I don't want to ruin the movie. if my middle son likes it enough and wants to see it again and wants to play, look at the high frame rate, that's fine.
Yeah.
I'll happily, he was unable to come with me to the screening, so he hasn't seen it at all.
Okay.
But in terms of the audio visual theatrical experience, it lived up to the hype.
Yes.
And let me also say something else. Mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of big films that we've seen over the last few years, and it being the most obvious example, you could hear every single line of dialogue crystal clear.
Yes. 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 No.
Which is something that you didn't used to have to take advantage of, something that you used to be able to take for granted.
No, that I definitely agree with, because there's so many times we watch a movie and especially they're mumbling or something. It's just sound, you can't hear it. Yes. And that's frustrating. This, you could understand everything. Granted, you have to, sometimes, things are happening, but you can hear every line clearly, which is, I didn't even think about that till you said that, but it's true. But I am excited to see it again. I mean, if you're going to go take your kids to go see it, did you find any issues with the runtime? I guess that's where I'll segue. Did you find, and unless you want to talk about anything with the visuals, but I did want to talk about the pacing and editing a little bit, if that's okay.
I mean, they've seen they've seen their share of long movies.
Okay.
Putting aside, will they sit through it? Because they will.
Well, of course.
They might get grouchy, but they'll stick around. But I do think it's longer than it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a tighter, sharper, more disciplined 2.5 hour cut somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a, not to be a nitpicky schmuck, because, I don't think we necessarily needed an entire episode of, fantastical whaling adventures.
Mm.
But that's also the kind of excess that, like, because only James Cameron can get away with that, you might as well let him have his whaling subplot.
Right.
Why not turn this into Star Trek The Voyage Home for 30 minutes?
Right.
For you young people, Star Trek IV The Voyage Home is a film that came out in 1986, I believe. It involved the U.S. Spock and Kirk and the gang traveling back in time to 1987 to bring back now extinct humpback whales to save the world.
Okay. Well, that's a good, I just did an interview recently and an actor kept trying to put me on to Star Trek. I've never seen Star Trek. So any Star Trek movies I know, I'm sorry. I was more of a Star Wars kid, but I did want to ask you a couple things about what you just said there. First, did you see, I kept trying to verify this as you were talking. Apparently, did you see that Avatar 3 has like you know what? I'm not going to say that because I don't know if it's true.
Bullshit.
Okay, it is. I figured so.
It was sourced from a random from what I gathered. I'm going off. I did not click on the link. It got jump covered and aggregated by Discussing the Film, which is a Twitter account.
Yes.
That basically steals everybody else's hard work and puts the headline in the tweet.
Right.
From what I gather, it was from like a YouTube video from people kind of sort of maybe possibly familiar with the picture.
Yep.
So no, I do not think there's a 9-hour cut of Avatar 3 that James Cameron's going to spend all the time and money to do all the special effects before cutting it down to 3 hours.
Right. Okay. Because that's
so be it. But
yes. Okay.
And well, obviously, my grouchiness is not directed at you.
No, of course. But I mean, I didn't know. And I'd seen it just before we hopped on. I saw that and I had to try to find the link again. And when I saw Discussing Film, I was only hesitant because I know there's some parody accounts out there that'll be discussing film, yeah. But they switch the L and the I. So then it looks like it's the real account. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that that's true. But I will say with a 3-hour long Avatar The Way of Water, I didn't mind the runtime as much as I minded just the pacing of it a little bit. I know early on we kind of jump around a lot and we get into the main story quickly, which I always appreciate, it felt to me at least. But once Sully and his family go to the I'm just gonna call it the Waterlands because I don't remember what it's called or how to pronounce it. It felt like it was I know that's why we're here, right? I guess we're here to see Sully's family, we're here to see those visuals, but there were times where it felt a little unbalanced where I'm thinking to myself, well, they're being hunted, and we're not seeing a whole lot of the hunters. I mean, we jump back and forth a little bit, especially once Spider gets kidnapped, you know, and is with them. But it felt to me unbalanced, where there were a few times where we'd see the hunters for maybe 5 minutes, and then we jump back to the water for probably, I don't know, it felt like a half hour, probably was 20 minutes. And I get it to a degree, but did it feel at all uneven to you? Because to me, it just did feel a little too lopsided.
I think they had just enough of the hunters.
Okay.
I just think the second act was a little padded, but you know, it's. I think to a certain extent, it was James Cameron sort of adhering to his own formula that served him very well in Titanic and in the first Avatar, which is an hour of table setting, an hour of character relationships and an exploratory adventure, and then the third act is slam bam, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, right.
And whenever I rewatch the first Avatar, I'm always very impressed at how little action there is in the film, because it was sold and to a certain extent it was embraced as this, you know, big budget action adventure spectacular.
Yeah.
And really, there's bits of violence here and there where appropriate in the story, but there's only that, you know, the tragic downing of the Tree of Life, which is, you know, the 9/11 moment, all due respect,
right,
in the end of the second act. And then there's a 20 to 25 minute, depending on which cut you watch, you know, 20 to 25 minute, you know, action finale. And other than that, it is a movie about people who live on Pandora. And introducing us to that world, having our characters learn about that world, and the political machinations that are going on with the Sky People. You know, it's not Speed.
Right.
It's not, you know, we're Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's sort of nonstop action. And I think Cameron wanted to go that route here, too. Because, you know, it's almost this time around more so, I think, that if it was up to him, he would have a lot less action. But he knows he needs to deliver that to justify everything else.
Right.
And I think to a certain extent, you know, I don't want to mistakenly quote him, but I almost feel like he said that once or twice during the publicity tour, where it's like, I want to make this preachy, tree-hugging environmental fable, but you give them the fireworks so people actually show up.
Right.
And right. So that they are invested in this, you know, all due respect, Fern Gully type movie with, you know, that kind of environmental messaging. But because this you know, it has almost an entire hour of kick-ass action, you know, it plays to people that wouldn't otherwise show up to something like that.
Right.
But I do think the third act is almost more padded than the second act, because I did find the action very redundant.
Right.
I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that Jake's kids eventually find themselves in peril. It might be a slight spoiler. They find themselves repeatedly in peril.
Yeah, right. Right. I'm with you on that.
There's a character that makes a joke about that, which is great. But again, pointing out the problem doesn't absolve the problem.
Yes, that is true. I wish I had recently said that about a movie, and I wish I could. I think it was a franchise movie. I wish I could remember which one it was. Doesn't matter. But no, that is frustrating. I was saying it to my sister on the way back from the screening that it was kind of annoying how many times the kids got captured, and then I guess we can give light spoilers because the movie's out. People are seeing it tonight, and it'll come out. The podcast will be out Friday.
I think my favorite action sequence in the picture is the one that is in the first act where they're are facing very personal peril within Pandora, and it sort of establishes the threat in a very intimate and plausible and frightening way. And one thing I do like about this picture is that even as the action gets big in that third act, it's a much more smaller scale, personal, intimate action adventure sequence. You know, without going into spoilers, you know, they're not trying to send off Helm's Deep. And you can tell that Cameron is trying to do something that isn't just another giant masses of armies coming together and beating each other.
Even if the ship starts sinking, but other than that, it's still very
Which, you
personal.
know, it's you know, to a certain extent, it's sort of a mix and match. And a lot of the film, and this isn't necessarily a criticism, it almost feels like a greatest hits of Cameron's greatest hits. Because you have bits and pieces from Titanic, you have bits and pieces from Avatar, Aliens. I don't know if Piranha 2, it's been a while, but let's say Piranha 2 is also in there, why not? And so as, you know, the film overall does feel a little redundant, both in terms of stuff that we've seen in the first Avatar and stuff that happens earlier in the second Avatar, again, it's repeated again later on in the second Avatar. And I will admit, you know, I understand why you bring back a character like Quidditch, because Stephen Lang is very good in the role and it makes the stakes personal. But there is something a little like, okay, he already killed this guy. So this isn't, you know, it's, I'm less invested than I might have been if this was somewhat of a new threat. In the same way that, you know, when the mummy returns, oh, it's the same fucking mummy. Now, I don't care that I'm not as emotionally invested in the mummy returns because it's the mummy returns. It's the mummy returns. Nobody, you know, nobody expects, you know, tear-jerking emotional oops in the mummy returns. The part where you tell me that you've never seen The Mummy Returns because you're too young.
Well, I haven't seen The Mummy Returns, but that's not because I'm too young. That just was another. A lot of the movies I saw when I was a kid were things my dad showed me. My cousins have watched it, and they talked about it a lot growing up, but I'd never seen it. I know that's Brendan Fraser, right? That's
Yes,
so pre
it's
the
not the
whale.
Tom
Okay.
Cruise one.
No, of course
Yes.
not.
The
But
Mummy movies are why everyone loves Brendan Fraser now.
yes,
I mean,
yes.
a few other movies too. I mean, he's a very good and interesting and fun actor. And if
Yes.
I may slightly digress, he can do that swashbuckling hero thing really well, as can Orlando Bloom. And if you've seen Prince of Persia or John Carter, you know that not everybody can do that. All due respect.
But on the topic of Stephen Lang, I do believe that, and you might have saw this as well, I think I didn't realize he was announced for the sequel. I also didn't realize he was announced for the other sequels as well. Was that well-known knowledge? If not, that's a spoiler. I'm sorry. I didn't know if
No,
I
he was
was.
announced a while ago. And this isn't a criticism at all. I would say, with the exception of one or two plot beats that I'm not even going to hint at, there aren't a ton of surprises in this film. It's not that kind of movie. It's not supposed to be. I mean, nobody walks into True Lies thinking, oh my God, those plot twists were amazing. That's not why you go.
Well, that confuses me why. I mean, that they took our phones at the screening, and that made me a little surprised because truthfully, the only other time I'd have to do that was at Spider-Man: No Way Home, which I understood because it was, I got that. But in this film, I mean, I get the visuals, but even if I took a bootleg video, this would be worse than a bootleg video.
I think that's what they're afraid, honestly, with the caveat that I don't think there's ever been a recorded case of piracy at a press screening. Fuck you very much. Obviously, not you, that's directed at them.
Right.
But I can just see them being concerned of some asshole videotaping the movie on his phone, putting excerpts on Twitter, and everybody going pointing and laughing. They're like, this looks so dumb. Ha,
right.
Ha, ha.
Right. The Cruella syndrome. Remember that opening scene? Yes, people took Cruella, that 5-second clip.
Yes, absolutely. It's like, I'm sorry. If you're making a live action movie based on Cruella and you don't want her mother to be pushed off a cliff by dogs, what the fuck are you doing here?
It's true. It's true. No, I'm with you. I guess that makes more sense. I was just a little annoyed because you know the process. I mean, I put my phone in a little brown paper bag.
It's a pain in the butt.
Ugh. But
the thing that always drives me nuts is that when Disney does it at premieres, which never start on time. So
yes.
It's like you're sitting there for like an hour and you're bored. Yes. Other major criticism with the film.
Yes.
Is that I felt that Zoe Saldana was very much backwards compared to the first film.
Yes.
And I think overall it was a far more male-centric picture than the first film, which was more of a two-hander.
Mm-hmm.
And while I, you know, if you tell me, oh, there's gonna be more in the third film, and that's fine, but this is the movie I'm watching. And, you know, this isn't, you know, especially James Cameron, who, for what it's worth, always believes that you shouldn't have to see the original to do the sequel. You know, I don't want, you know, my issues with part two, you know, waved away because, oh, don't worry, it'll be better in part three. Okay, but we're talking about part two.
Right. Well, I mean,
somebody that thinks that the best thing about Avatar, other than the visuals, I guess, was Zoe Saldana's performance. I was a little annoyed that she was pushed in the background as sort of the scared, grieving mother for much of the film.
Right. And I mean, I would almost argue, I mean, that's kind of how I felt in all honesty about the adult characters in total. I mean, I know, of course, Sully is our main character, Jake. You know, of course, he's going to be. He's the center of the plot, but even at that point, I felt like once we got to the Waterlands, it kind of was more about the kids, which I understand. You're trying to set them up to be bigger players down the road, right? And I do want to talk about the kids in a second, but I did feel like the adults were kind of just, once they were there, they had their conflicts, but it really was so much centered on the kids. I felt like we missed a lot of Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana.
I agree. I mean, in a skewed way, it's sort of like it's a legacy sequel, which means... Yeah. You know, the advantaged vets are sort of the mentor characters, while the younger, quote-unquote, more diverse cast are being set up as the leads.
Yes.
And I'm guessing, and this is not any inside information, that by Avatar 4, they'll be the full-on protagonists.
Right, right.
And on one hand, that's fine, because when you do a legacy sequel, you want something like, you know, Star Wars, where, you know, Rey, Finn, and Poe are the new heroes.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to... You know, the Rise of Skywalker, where they kind of backfilled on or, you know, Independence Day Resurgence, where you introduce all these new people, but nobody gives a shit about them. It's still the Jeff Goldblum and Bill Pullman show.
Yep.
And even Top Gun Maverick, that was one of the reasons I wasn't as big on that as other people were, is it felt to me like that kind of legacy sequel where, you know, the new franchise vets get pushed in the background. So Grandpa's favorite hero can still save the day. And it makes sense in that movie. You know, I admit that I'm being kind of a dick about that. But in a vacuum, that makes sense. Since the movie is basically about how Hollywood did such a shitty job of making new movie stars that Tom Cruise still has to get up off the bench and save the day.
Right.
But I think in the broader macro culture, alongside The Rise of Skywalker, Ghostbusters Afterlife, Independence Day Resurgence, even the Matrix Resurrections to a certain extent. It was like, it's another fucking legacy sequel where, you know, Grandpa's favorite heroes are the real, you know, the real saviors.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, again, that may not be fair to Top Gun Maverick, I admit that. But that's how I felt on the first viewing.
Yeah. No, I mean,
so, I mourn the less screen time for, especially for Zoe Saldana, and also for Sam Worthington, I also must put my money where my mouth is and say it's also a legacy sequel where the young kids are coming into their own.
Okay, so that transitions very well. I appreciate that segue right into the kids. I wanted to ask you about the newbies of the cast. I was having trouble finding, looking at a list and trying to figure out the characters is a lot harder than it seems. I hope anybody listening gives me some grace with that. But what did you think about the new kids? I know Samara Weaving, Sigourney Weaver. plays
Wait, what?
the new character. I don't know. I'm sorry. My mind was on Barbie, I think.
No.
But Sigourney Weaver, of course, comes back as Kiri? Kiri, that's the character's name. I can pronounce that one.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, that's the only one that threw me off. I liked all the kids, but I think something about seeing part of her face on the character and the voice as this little kid, there were times where I was thinking, that does not sound like a little kid, and it was a little, it sounds like Sigourney Weaver, and it only threw me off a little bit, not that much. But what did you think about the kids overall, and specifically Sigourney Weaver's?
I don't disagree with you about the Sigourney Weaver thing. It didn't bother me just because it didn't take me out of the movie much.
No, of
And, but
course.
it was sort of like, why are we doing this? I get the sort of the chutzpah of, I could cast Sigourney Weaver as her own daughter. Ha ha ha. But it sort of feels like, to paraphrase another franchise, just because you could doesn't mean you should. And
Right.
it didn't bother me, but it sort of felt like one of those, well, Cameron's just doing this because he can.
Right.
And because it feels like a fun challenge to him.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, fine, whatever. As far as the kids, I mean, obviously the middle child is the bulk of the screen time
Yep.
and the emphasis.
Yes.
You know, he is the he's Charlie Cosmo in a book. Another movie that you might be too young to have seen. Fair enough. But yeah, he is clearly being set up as a new protagonist. And I think the older brother was kind of a blank slate to a certain extent. And other than that, I think the kids were fine. I like the very, very young child just because obviously putting her in mortal danger ups the ante in terms of tension and suspense because she's basically like a baby who barely understands what's going on around her. And so that, you know, pulls at the, you know, it's a cheap shot, but it works. So yeah, I think the kids were fine. And I think we'll see in the third one to the extent that they become more than just, oh, these are Jake and Sully's kids. I'm sorry, these are more than Jake and Nedry's kids who are basically almost there, almost entirely to be imperiled.
But I what did you think about I because I do I agree with much of what you said. I did like the older wait, which one was the older daughter? Oh, that was Sigourney Weaver. I'm getting them confused now. It's only been a couple of days, but I did like the whole sort of it's almost like a high school movie, that sort of conflict they have with the other
Yes.
kids. I enjoyed that more. I usually am not a fan of that kind of plot line, especially because you can see it coming from a mile away. Although I will say, it seemed a little extreme to cast the one kid, the middle
Murder.
child out. Yeah, we cast him out to sea with, Moby Dick, the equivalent of Pandora's Moby
That's
Dick.
I mean, that's attempted murder. Full stop. And yes, I agree with you. That was a little like, you know, in movie logic, it's one of those things that's like, okay, in the real world, that would not be just brushed off.
I mean, I think Stephen
I remember in
King.
the first,
Oh, go ahead.
yeah, in the first like, in the first Bad Moms movie, I did not, you know, I thought it was ridiculous that the second act climax had one of the daughters being framed for drug possession. And it's sort of brushed off as a, oh, you know, we're friends now. Like, you're gonna
Yes.
ruin your fucking life.
I know. Yes, I'm.
Are you aware of what the drug laws are in this country?
It's funny you mentioned
Anyway.
Bad Moms. I have to rewatch the second one. That's a fun Christmas movie.
No,
I
you
enjoy
don't.
that one. Is it really that bad? It's been a while since I've seen it.
It's relentlessly mediocre.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, then maybe I won't do
It's,
that.
it, you know, it's the same problem that I have with the first film, which is that it punishes Mila Kunis's character for breaking out and trying to have fun. And it has everyone in the movie blaming her for stuff that she didn't cause and she didn't do. She's the one that has to learn a lesson.
Okay, interesting. Well, clearly I don't
Anyway.
remember the movie that well, but back on the topic of the kids, I mean, the attempted murder and all that, but I did kind of enjoy that sort of and that blossoming love. I mean, it sounds silly because seeing the Na'vi fall in love, it's kind of like it's not humans, but you still felt some connection. I guess it's a testament to how it comes off on the screen, at least to myself. I thought it was quite touching, but did they just was it just
Well,
me or
it's
did
funny that,
Oh, go ahead.
no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you
No,
go
it's
ahead.
just
You
you,
finish it.
but, well, no, it just, the romantic subplot, there was almost non-existent. I mean, that's the one scene in the trailer where she says, I see you in a vaguely romantic courtship sense. And that's all there really is in the movie,
I guess
other
that's
than
fair.
he's hot And on one hand, it was nice that they're both clearly into each other, yeah, and they weren't having to win each other over. Yeah. That sort of, that could sometimes be a waste of time.
Yeah.
But, oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, well, maybe that, maybe I felt it was touching just because I'm coming off of one of the worst romantic movies I've ever watched. Did you ever see All Summer's End?
No, I haven't.
Well, it has Caitlin Dever in it. I think it was filmed in 2013. So, and then it came out in 2018, I think. So it's not good. And it's very, it's in my favorite subgenre of Caitlin Dever as a shitty manipulative boyfriend. And that is the first installment in that. Dear Evan Hansen would be the second one. But
that's everyone's favorite franchise.
Exactly. But that's my one Caitlin Dever mention per podcast. But back to the topic at hand. Never too many. back to the topic at hand, I think that I do see what you're saying. I guess I might have been coming off of that, but experience of watching a bad romantic movie and kind of, but I don't know, I did find it touching weirdly, even if it was kind of non-existent. But speaking of non-existent, is it just me or did all the water people just disappear in the third act? Did I miss something? Did I blink?
Basically disappeared in the third act.
But was it at least explained? Because the movie ended, and I thought to myself, I'm like, did they just dip? Like, where did they go? Because they welcomed them at the end, you know?
I don't know.
Okay, so I'm not alone.
it's for someone like James Cameron, who usually is a master of plotting.
Yeah.
And just simple storytelling. That's why, you know, people bitch about, Avatar's got a bad script because the dialogue is cheesy, or Titanic as a bad script, the dialogue is cheesy. I'm like, fuck you, it's a plotting, dude. You don't have to plot a movie.
Right.
And this one felt sloppy by his standards.
Yes. Okay.
And when I do see it again, that will be something that I'll be paying attention to, if some of it just, you know, flew by me because I was immersed in the moment.
Right. So literally flew by you. yeah. But okay, well, I'm glad to hear that though, because I really thought I just blinked and I missed something, because I was confused when it ended, because I guess I won't spoil what happens at the end. Forget what I was saying, but yeah, I mean, to kind of wrap, I wanted to ask you, because since you didn't review it, what would be your score of it, and then I have a follow up to that.
7 out of 10, okay. Maybe 8 if I'm in a good mood.
Okay.
And again, that's good. It's a 3.5 stars if I'm being generous. The fact that I liked the original better, it also had a more primal story. So you had the luxury of telling that very primal, person of the, face of the oppressed becomes, or face of the oppressor aligns themselves with the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I liked that it told a very different story.
Yeah.
I liked it was smaller and more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that, it didn't, with all the talk about how the first film was, this white savior story or this macho heroic fantasy, the sequel busts that open pretty friggin' quickly.
Yes.
I mean, no spoilers, but he's not the leader of Pandora for very long in this film.
Yeah.
And when the shit goes down, his reaction is to be scared shitless and run away.
Hmm.
And that's very relatable.
Yep. yes. Well, one final question for you before I do have to let you go, I guess, is I think I know the answer to this, but it feels like with the, award season heating up, everybody's talking about what's going to be in Best Picture, and you might not even give a shit, but I still wanted to ask, if one blockbuster movie gets in, maybe two get in, but if just say if one gets into Best Picture this year, if it's Top Gun, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, or Avatar, Way of Water, what do you think is deserving, and also what do you think will happen? Because I think a lot of people now that Avatar, they're pushing that into that category for conversation.
Honestly, I think of those, I think Avatar, if you want to do better or worse than, Wakanda Forever, Forever more than Top Gun, mm-hmm. but they're all three star, maybe 3.5 star for Avatar pictures.
Right.
That being said, I do not think Wakanda Forever is going to get a Best Picture nomination.
Okay.
I think I think frankly, this would be a positive thing. Woman King. Which was a very well-received, well-reviewed, populist studio programmer that was very successful domestically.
Mm-hmm.
And is the kind of film that we want Hollywood to make more of.
Yes, right.
And I think, being cynical for a second, that gives them an out if they were concerned that not nominating Wakanda Forever would make them look bad.
Right.
But as far as blockbusters, you know, I think Top Gun's absolutely going to get in. Okay. I think Elvis is going to get in.
Right. Yeah.
I think Avatar will probably get in, mm-hmm. unless it bombs, and I don't think it's going to bomb.
Oh.
Because it gets the whole, savior of films type shtick.
Right.
And unlike Spider-Man No Way Home, it's not just a triumph of contract negotiation.
True, but does it gross $2 billion, do you think, Avatar 2?
I think a lot will depend on how well it's received in China.
Okay.
Because if it plays if it does $400 million in China, which is possible, that's going to make up for a lot of, drop off everywhere else.
Yeah.
Okay. And obviously we don't know what the word of mouth is yet, but I do think that a lot of people are going to say, I liked Avatar. I have no objection to visiting Pandora because it's been 13 freaking years.
Right.
And they're going to show up.
Yeah.
And I think for people that are less nitpicky than me, they're going to have a hell of a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I think it has a solid shot at $2 billion worldwide.
Okay. Okay.
I don't want to look crazy and say $3 billion. Again, obviously, if it goes bananas everywhere and goes bananas in China, that's where you talk about $3 billion.
Right.
But let's see what happens over the next week.
Right. Well, and it's only interesting because you have two more sequels coming out, presumably in the next 4 years, 5 years, whatever, or six. I don't remember what years they're slotted for.
I think Avatar 2 does the most important job, which is that it's good enough and interesting enough and exciting enough to get people at least casually curious for Avatar 3.
Yes. Right.
They might not be sitting on pins and needles, but they're like, okay, yeah, I'll see another one of these in 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This isn't Fantastic Beasts: The Crimes of Grindelwald, which was such a shit show that it killed the entire franchise.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's kind of a poetic way to wrap up. You just said good enough again. It's good enough.
Yeah.
As long as the third one's not 9 hours long, I'm sure you're right. People will keep showing up. I don't know if we're
pretty sure it's going to not be nice. Yeah.
But that said, Scott,
maybe he'll release a 9-hour cut in black and white and 4x3.
Black and white. The only black and white cut I need to see of a movie is Nightmare Alley from last year, because I missed it when it was in theaters. Other than that, I don't really give a shit. But but that said, Scott, it's been great speaking with you. Do you have any other final thoughts on Avatar before I let you go?
I am as curious and excited to read the box office as anyone else. And while I will not be doing the conventional box office coverage for the wrap, I probably will do a post here and there over the weekend for China.
Yes.
So, if I happen to, very briefly discuss the other numbers without stepping on the toes of Jeremy Foster, who does very good coverage at the wrap, I will, then so be it.
Please do, Scott. I always, everybody loves your box office stuff. That's what, I've been reading you since high school doing that. So
so is Jeremy.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, there's two people now to make you feel old, and that was my last little old jab at you before. Let you go. But Scott, where can the people find you? And I'll make sure to link your stuff at the wrap in the description, of course.
I'm at the wrap. I'm still putting out content there, and then I am still at Twitter.
Yes, and at Scott Mendelson.
I don't have an Instagram. Yeah, at Scott Mendelson.
Yep.
And I don't have an Instagram. I don't have a Hive. I don't have a Mastodon. I no longer have a MySpace.
Oh, okay.
What are all the Kill Cool Kids doing now? Now the Twitter's going down.
OnlyFans coming soon, I think. I'm just.
I need to lose some weight before I do an OnlyFans.
No, I'm just kidding.
I need to lose some of this.
Well, of course.
I've got like a one pack.
So no, Scott. It's all positive vibes here, of course. And, I always love your work, so I will...
I appreciate it.
Yes, well, thank you so much, Scott. We'll have you back on soon, and I'll talk to you soon. I guess I just said soon twice
in a row. Absolutely. Thank you so much for letting me do this.
Yes, of course.
Now that I know that this will actually work...
Yes.
I might do this kind of thing more often when I'm taking what's a very long drive home for me.
Definitely. More to come. Well,
This
thank
was an
you.
absolute pleasure.
Yes, thank you for everyone for listening.